This is episode 56, recorded April 4th, 2011. Greetings, everybody.
Hi.
So many fish species, so little time. Where are we going to go first? Well, first we just want to make a little...
Disclaimer,
I guess. Kelly's having a little...
I have a cold.
And so... It's
sound funny.
It's going to be a little hard for her to talk as much as she usually does. And... we can all be
coughing. If I cough, I will try not to.
Although her coughs are not as loud as mine. And Mike, thanks for your email about that. That was funny.
Yes, we laughed.
We laughed because Mike was mentioning how my coughs were rather strong. And I'm getting better at going back and editing them to be quiet, like I did for at least one of them in the last show. So we'll try to keep that down. But second, we're going to... talk to you a little bit about all the ways that Aquarimax can be accessed via the web. So,
just to tell anybody, if anybody's new, all the different ways you can talk to us.
Okay. Well, the first way is to contact our Google Voice number, which is right on the website, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, okay? It's 801-477-0629. This is Google Voice, but that shouldn't scare you away if you're less technologically inclined, because it works
like a voicemail service.
Yeah, it works the same way as voicemail. So all you have to do is call the number anytime you want and leave a message. You can call with a landline, you can call with a cell phone, whatever, and it works just the same way as a normal telephone, except nobody will answer it. We'll just get a message. And
yeah, so if you call and say, hello, hello, pick up, it won't work.
Right. But it will send a recorded version of the message to us, and so then we can play that message on the air, and there you go. That's a good way to participate in the show. You can also email us at...
info@aquarimax.com.
Okay. And those have been the most longstanding ways to do it, to be part of the show. But fairly recently, we also got a Facebook page for Aquarimax, so if you just... go to Facebook and look for Aquarimax. You can find us, you can like us, and people are doing that, just gradually adding on, and we'd love it if you'd go do that right now, or this week, or something. No pressure, though. You can also find us on Twitter, at Aquarimax. That's another way. And the final way that you can do it is...
get us on YouTube.
Yep, Aquarimax has a YouTube channel, so just go to YouTube.
Fishy videos.
Yeah, and put Aquarimax in the search, and we'll pop up, and you can subscribe to us if you want. You can send us messages that way. Some of you have done that already. Like Andreka has sent us several messages via YouTube, so that works well, too. So there you go. Several ways you can contact Aquarimax. We would also like to mention that we love interviewing people. We just interviewed Brian last week, and not too long before that, we interviewed Carlos, and we interviewed Dave, and we'd like to interview more of you. So, basically, this is the idea.
If you have a project, or if you have kept or bred a species that we have not talked about yet, send us an email, or, you know, a Google Voice, any of these things that we just talked about. Send us a message with what you... would like to contribute to the show and give us some information about, you know, what you would be talking about and stuff, and we'll see what we can work out.
Yeah, we'd like to set something up. So, for example, if you keep bumblebee gobies, I've never kept bumblebee gobies, we haven't, that would be fun. Or maybe you've bred blind cavefish. We've kept them, but we haven't bred them. And so on. Just anything that we haven't really discussed on the show.
You're putting a full-scale waterfall into your bathroom as a decorative feature with goldfish.
Oh, that'd be fun. Woohoo! They'd love that. So think about, you know, anything that could be... maybe it's a species we've talked about, but you have some things to add to it, or, you know, different techniques or something like that. So please contact us, drop us a line. And, of course, you can always call us if you have... questions, various questions about a specific topic, and you'd like to interview us about them. You know, something that you're wanting to work on, and maybe it's something we know nothing about, but it might be, so we can give that a go. So either way, contact us and we'll see what we can do. So let's hit the emails and messages that we received this week. Or prior to this week, but in the last couple of weeks.
Okay. First one is from Russ in Wisconsin. And he says he loves the podcast. Yay for us! And he has a question. He says, I have read many articles regarding cycling the water in a new tank. I understand the basic chemistry and the benefit of adding surface area from a mature tank to speed things up. Why can't you simply take water from your mature tank from a 20% water change and add it into the new tank? If you add 80% or more fresh water, won't that give you proper water conditions very quickly? Of course, only if you have a healthy tank to start with. And he is planning to move to a larger tank. He's going to pull the filters, rocks, gravel, and fish from his older tank and move them to the newer, bigger tank. He says, of course, he's going to test the water before putting the fish in, but he wants to know if we approve of that technique of adding water from the old tank. So, what do you think about that?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is, as Russ says, that the benefit of adding surface area from a mature tank does speed things up, and that is really the key there, is that most of the lithotrophic bacteria, the kinds that we're looking for to change ammonia to nitrite and then to nitrate, are very important, of course. They're vital in the process, and they need surface area. Oh, having a few technical difficulties with the file cabinet over here. Just a second. All right. So, since they need the surface area, there aren't a whole lot of those bacteria floating around in the water column. There are probably a few, but not enough to do a whole lot. However, moving all of those things that he mentions, the filter, rocks, gravel, and fish, from the old tank will help a lot, because a lot of that surface area will be preserved, and so those bacteria will also be preserved and as you move over to the other tank. It is also of benefit to move that water.
So that's a good idea.
Yes, moving the water is a good idea for several reasons. One is because it's water the fish are already comfortable with, they're used to, and so on. It's not going to be as much of a shock to have that water in there. But another reason is because water that comes straight out of the tap is often contains pressurized gases. And so those gases, once they're not in the pipes and they're not under pressure anymore, they start to come out of the solution and they nucleate and start bubbling everywhere. So, if you put fish into a tank that is mostly new water, you have some issues. Not only do you have temperature issues and so on that you, in theory, could work out by carefully monitoring the amount of hot water and cold water that go into the tank and dechlorinating it and so on as you put it in, but that outgassing, as it is called, where you let that occur, can be very dangerous if you're doing it in the tank with the fish, because basically the gas can come out of solution in a way that damages the fish's tissues, both inside and outside of the fish, and it can be fatal, and it's certainly stressful.
Think new paint smell. Living in a room full of new paint, it's stinky. Until it dissipates.
In a way, it's kind of like that. And it's like the bends. It's like getting the bends for a deep sea diver, it's something like that, because when you rise up towards the surface, all that nitrogen that was in under pressure when you were under pressure is no longer under pressure, and so it starts forming in bubbles inside your blood, and that's why people get the bends. And so it's very similar to that process in a lot of ways. Well, if you're using a large proportion of older water from your tank, you don't have to worry about that. If you're not using a large proportion of water for your own tank, you should at least let the tank outgas for 24 hours with some sort of water movement in the tank, a power head or something, running in there to help the tank outgas before you put the fish in. But I do heartily approve of moving a large quantity of the water into the tank. So, and it depends, of course, on the size of the tank and practicality and so on. But it's much of... If you could move 80% of the water from the old tank and just fill it up with 20%, that would be ideal. But if you can't do that, maybe 50-50 or something like that, and just give the tank some time to outgas. But I think moving all that bacterially colonized surface area from your original tank to the new tank will make a big difference. And you might get some slight cycling as things adjust and the size of the tank and different things. And depending on how quickly you're able to move it and how little or how much you end up disturbing the bacteria in terms of temperature and water conditions and so on, it might not be an issue at all. You might be fine and not have to worry about any cycling. You might get a mini spike that you might be able to take care of with some of the ammonia-reducing chemicals out there that allow the bacteria to continue their cycle without any difficulty, just to take the edge off the problem. But I think it's a good idea. I think that should work for you just fine, as long as you pay attention to those issues.
Okay. Next.
So thank you, Russ, for your email. We appreciate it, and good luck with that, and let us know how it goes.
Okay, we have another message from Andreka in Oregon. Now she's talking about her shrimp in this message. You want to fill us in on the background of this?
Okay, sure.
Because we're kind of jumping in kind of mid-conversation here for them. So.
Okay. Andreka has contributed several times before and offered some good suggestions as well. And so this is not the first time we've heard from Andreka, of course. She has recently embarked on the adventure of fish keeping, and they've set up an aquarium with several fish and so on, some gouramis and bettas and things like that. But she has three amano shrimp, or she said originally they had three amano shrimp. And amano shrimp, for those of you who might not know, are a shrimp made famous by Takashi Amano, the Japanese nature aquarium artist. He popularized these shrimp in Japan, where they can be found, because of their great algae-eating capabilities in planted aquaria. So they're fairly popular aquarium shrimp for those reasons, and we have several of them. I like them.
We like them.
Yeah, they're nice. So she had three. Two of them disappeared completely within days of their arrival. And Andreka did some research and thought maybe they had just burrowed, been hiding somewhere in the tank, which is quite probable in general. I mean, just to give an example of that, I put some amano shrimp in a 37-gallon planted tank, and shortly thereafter did not see them for months. And I am literally speaking in months, and not just two. It was more like nine or perhaps more. Did not see them.
9 months or nine shrimp?
9 months.
9 months.
For about three or four shrimp, and I thought they were gone. And then I saw a molted shrimp skin in the tank and began to look for them and found that they were just as happy as clams or as happy as shrimp or whatever. they were there in the tank and doing fine. So that is not an unreasonable possibility. But in Andreka's case, she said she had done some water changes and moved the landscape around and still only found one shrimp. And she said her boyfriend, Pat, says he wondered if the lone shrimp, who they named Ernest Henry Small, which I thought was cool.
That's a good name.
She said the shrimp might have killed the other two shrimp, but they hadn't seen any sign of these other shrimp. And I think it's probably not too likely that they that the other shrimp killed, that Ernest Henry Small killed the other shrimp. But I would suspect other fish in the tank, because any fish in the tank, if they can, the rule is, if a fish can fit something in its mouth, it will. If a fish can't fit something in its mouth, it might try. And it just
maybe
might
it
succeed.
Will fit part of it in its mouth.
Yes. So, a mono shrimp can get pretty big, but so can some of the other fish in there, in your tank. And not sure what size of a mono shrimp you started out with. But also, one thing is that when a shrimp molts, its skin is extremely soft. And we're talking like butter soft. It gets really soft. I have seen, I had a tank in Hawaii with, let's see, what did I have in there? Corydoras punctatus, a fairly common aquarium catfish. And what else was it? White clouds and neons, I think. Or white clouds or neons at the time. I switched it around between white clouds and neons at different times. So, you know, both white clouds and neons are fairly inoffensive fish, and Corydoras punctatus are also fairly inoffensive fish, not very large or anything. But I had lots of red cherry shrimp in the tank. One day, I looked into the tank to see one of the Cory cats just slurp up a shrimp, a recently molted shrimp, just slurped it up like spaghetti. It was not an issue at all. It was so soft.
That's not a pretty mental
picture. No, it's not. But its skin was so soft because it had just molted that the Cory was able to take care of it. And then other times I've seen white clouds and neons rip apart a newly molted shrimp too. So kind of disgusting, but such is life, I suppose. In well, it's a natural thing for fish to want to eat shrimp, I suppose. But at any rate, the idea behind this is that if a shrimp is not able to retreat to a suitable shelter after it has molted or during the molting process, it is very likely to be able to be slurped up by fish which would not normally be able to attack it. So that may have been what happened to Ernest. It is possible. Then let's see. Ernest is still alive. The other two shrimp, Ernest's conspecific cohorts. That's what I meant.
That's a great phrase.
Yeah, it's a good name for a band, conspecific cohorts. There you go. Okay. So, Andreika's other question. Also, is it okay to feed a mono shrimp brine shrimp? Yes, it is. She's wondering if that's kind of cannibalistic, but not really, because a mono shrimp and brine shrimp are quite distantly related. Brine shrimp, calling them shrimp is actually a little bit of a stretch. They're not very closely related at all. Although they are crustaceans together, they're not so close that we could qualify that as cannibalism. But then she asks, if the other small fish are eating brine shrimp, will they start to look at Ernest like supper? Well, they probably would anyway if they had a chance. And I don't think the introduction of brine shrimp will make much of a difference, frankly. So I don't think you have to worry about that. But as soon as Ernest molts, or he looks, he looks small enough to fit into one of their mouths, then yes, they will go for him. So it is important to provide a lot of hiding places for molting shrimp. I have successfully kept a mono shrimp with goldfish many times their size. As long as they have plenty of places to hide, they'll do fine. If the goldfish are not too fast, you know, I wouldn't do it with single-tailed goldfish, but with fancy goldfish, I think that's what I've done it with, and that works okay. But not that I necessarily recommend shrimp with goldfish in all cases. But anyway, there you go. They do need suitable hiding places, crevices and so on, that they can hide in for several days after they molt so that their exoskeletons can firm up. All right. Now,
so
we do have...
good luck to Ernest.
Right. Very good luck to Ernest. And actually, you know, Andreika had another question, and we want to talk about that a little bit. She was wondering a little bit about fish personalities. So let's talk a little bit about that. This was in a separate communication on Facebook. And
I was wondering about some... what would be like our favorite behaviors of fish? Or people's favorite behaviors of fish. Behaviors that are interesting that make you want to keep them.
Right, right. And she also mentioned that she noticed the gouramis and the betta are... And I know lots of people pronounce gouramis in different ways. That's my way. It doesn't mean my way is right, but anyway. There you go. And
oh,
betta and betta, too.
Right. Just admit
some
that
some people
you're
say
right.
Betta, some people say betta. But anyway, she says they're friendly.
Old school and call them a Siamese fighting fish.
With bettas?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Good.
Takes longer to say.
I once saw them marketed as rumblefish in a pet store many years ago.
Rumblefish?
Yeah.
So they put like a red one and a blue one together and they have a rumble?
I guess so. I don't know. I hope they wouldn't do that because that would be mean.
Well, you can't really make gang signs with fins, though, so I'm not sure what they would do, you know.
I don't know.
Sorry, I'm getting weird again.
No, I'm just hoping everyone can hear you because you're kind of far away from the mics.
And so. I have a cold!
Yes. Okay, so... we digress. The Grammys,
the NyQuil talking.
There you go. The Grammys and the Beta, even when they have their hands in the tank, are just friendly with Andreika and her boyfriend. So she said schooling fish are just not as fun for her, or for them, for Andreika and Patrick. And she said, what would you say the top 10 favored fish behaviors are, and if there are any specific fish names she should ask, and there are any significant contraindications, like Oscars will eat everything, or loaches can cut your hand if you're not careful, things like that. Basically, just saying, if they had known about the different temperaments of fish when they started out, they would have done it in a different way. Well, let's start out by top preferred behaviors of fish and kind of addressing this. I think one way to look at it is that fish have... How can I put this? Oh, you know what? We need to have a break. We skipped a break. Let's have the break right now.
Break!
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay, so the idea is that it depends on what you want from a tank, I think, what you want to see. There are different styles of tanks, and I would say that one style would be the just basic community tank, where you want to see a mixture of fish at different areas of, you know, in the water level. You want fish that spend a lot of time near the bottom, fish that spend a lot of time near the middle, and fish that spend most of their time on the top of the water, and you want to see a variety of colors and shapes and so on. So there's that. And in those cases, you know, schooling fish work, and then you have some others that are larger and maybe less in number, like maybe some gouramis and so on. And then you have maybe a school of corys down at the bottom and bristlenose, that kind of idea, where the idea is variety. That's what you're going for. You're going for variety. Then there's another kind of tank where you're going for a species tank, where you just want to keep one species in there, often to breed, or maybe just to showcase this particular species. Maybe it's a species that doesn't do well with other ones.
Like betas.
Yeah. Well, betas can do well with some other species, not with ones of their own kind.
I don't think they really get shown off very well when they're in a community tank.
No, they often look best when they're by themselves.
I think they're most impressed by themselves.
Yeah, and like we have our beta.
Oh, the sorority tank was cool.
Yeah. And you do things like that. So you can do a species tank, where you just want to showcase the unusual characteristics or interesting characteristics of a particular species. And then you've got a pet tank, where you have one or maybe two fish, where the whole point is to have these fish for them to display their behaviors, for them to interact with you, and so on.
Can I interject something? Because I think that kind of leads into... I think my favorite fish behavior, I like it when the fish will eat out of your hands. I think that's my favorite, because it's more interactive and it's more like a pet, less like, you know, a picture on the wall that happens to be moving. I think it's fun.
Right. And then,
like when we feed our goldfish peas or something, and they come up and snatch them, and then Bert flips around and splashes you with his tail every time.
Which he does invariably, a little
every
stinker.
Every time.
So I have to put the lid down really fast.
It's just his way of saying thank you.
It's a wet way of saying thank
yes.
you. But he does.
So you poor dried out humans here.
He invariably, does that. Susan doesn't do that.
Mm-mm.
Well, she's very well mannered. But
she's
anyway.
A bit more polite.
So when fish are... You interact with them as more of a pet, and the tank just happens to be where they live, and it can still look nice, but your purpose is to have that pet fish. You know, betas are one of the small fish that you can do that with, and there are others. Gouramis tend to be that way to some extent. One of my favorites that way is dojos, or weather loaches, as they're called. They're very personable little fish, and they'll come up to the top and they'll kiss your fingers. I think I've mentioned that before. With their little barbed faces, they're like Cooley loaches.
Faces, that's a great word, too.
Cooley loaches on steroids.
Barble, barble, barble!
Barble, barble, barble! They really are. They're like big, big fat Cooley loaches, but not with the same colors, but just big, fat, brown Cooley loaches, basically, is what they look like.
And they just like to play with you?
And they'll go right up to the surface of the water when it's time to eat, which Cooley loaches usually don't do, mm-hmm. and stick their barbels out of the water and make little kissy noises, which you can hear from across the room. So those are fun that way. And they don't require an absolutely huge tank either. So there's some ideas for small tanks of fish that are intended that way. Go ahead.
You're talking about, you know, keeping them to interact with. I was thinking of the betta that you had in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
And what you would do with the betta. So take a minute and tell them what you'd do with your betta in Italy. That was pretty cool.
Okay. Well, I don't recommend this because I have since learned this was a long time ago.
This was how many years ago this was?
Well,
like,
I was in my late teens, so it was a long time ago.
Long time ago.
Long time ago. But I had this betta, and I would go catch him wee insects. And then I would hold them above the... I would either press the insect against my finger until it was dazed or stunned, and so it would just stick there. And I'd hold my finger a couple of inches above the water, and my betta would jump out and grab it right off my finger. And he would jump out a couple of inches. He was fine with that. Really good at doing that. He wouldn't do it for flake food so much, but he'd do it for the insects. And then Italy has kind of a warm climate, and
we're in kind of scuzzy teenager apartments.
sometimes I was, and in a couple apartments that I was in, there were roaches, and
nasty creatures.
Yes, and he would eat those. At night, sometimes a roach would crawl into his bowl, and then in the morning I would find like a leg or a wing, and he would have torn, or sometimes I'd see him actually ripping one apart, and he would rip these little things up and eat them. And they were pretty big compared to him. I mean, they weren't bigger than he was, but they were about an inch long, and that's, you know, no mean feat. He would rip them apart. So I know that's kind of disgusting.
I think it's kind of cool.
There you go.
I'm all for anything that destroys roaches.
Yeah. And I don't recommend, as I said, that having them jump out of the water. If you train them to do that, they tend to be more likely to do it, whether or not you're there and whether or not there's a, you know, a cover on the tank. So that can be a very bad thing. So I don't recommend it. But there you go. That, it certainly demonstrates a lot of personality. Other fish that have a lot of personality, puffers. Pufferfish are famous for personality. A lot of people who keep puffers keep them for their interesting personality. The only kinds of puffers we've really kept have been dwarf puffers, but they certainly do have a lot of personality. The way they look at you, with their little eyes, the way they move like a chameleon's eyes and so on, and the way they stalk food, like stalk a snail and so on, is really interesting to watch. They're often not really great tank mates for anything, depending on the species. I mean, dwarf puffers more so than some other puffers. You can do better with tank mates in some cases, but some of the puffers, if they have a tank mate, their tank mate is lunch. That's just the way it is. But they can be interesting personality-wise. Cichlids, of course. Big personality.
Ooh, cichlids are cool.
Yeah, Oscars. A lot of people keep an Oscar for personality. An Oscar will eat anything it can fit in its mouth.
The mouth brooding is really interesting to watch, talking about behaviors. That was neat when we had ours, and we did get some babies.
It was
really cool.
Yeah, and then we had to move to Hawaii, and we had to sell the whole tank and
all
the fish.
Anything with us.
And everything. But the cichlids are very much more complex in behavior. Watching brood care, you know, like the mouth brooding, or you watch convict cichlids or angelfish, you know, lay the eggs on a leaf or on the glass or wherever they happen to lay them, and incubate the eggs, clean the eggs, and so on. Not incubate, like sit on them, but you know, they're there watching over them as the eggs develop, and then they take care of the fry. They'll pick up the fry in one corner and spit them into a pile somewhere else, and it's just fascinating to watch.
So breeding and parent care would be top behaviors that people would look for to be interesting in a fish, if you're looking for something interesting to watch.
Right. And, of course, fish recognizing people.
Yeah.
And
so
wanting
interaction
to be fed.
And breeding and Yeah. Parental care, those are good ones.
Right. Schooling behavior, if it's truly a tight school, you know, that can be really neat. If usually in most community tanks, there's not a whole lot of schooling going on unless it's carefully arranged so that it affords the opportunity for the fish to school.
Now, do they need something that feels slightly threatening for them to really school tightly?
Sometimes. It depends on the species. Some will school more tightly if they feel slightly threatened, and I'm not sure about the ethics of doing that.
Well, no, I wasn't suggesting it. No, I was just wondering if that's...
Yeah, I knew you weren't suggesting it. I'm not sure. You need to detect, you know, you need to find out what would be the correct level of threat for them to feel so they're not entirely stressed all the time, but at the same time they feel that they have to engage in the natural behavior of schooling and so on. So there's probably a good place where you can still do it and not stress them out too much. But, you know, you wouldn't want to put a big predator that could actually eat them in there. But sometimes you can put a fish that looks slightly threatening to them, but it's not enough to really cause them harm. But they'll tend to be together a little more tightly. But some of the other things, you just make sure they have a tank that's long enough, and you make sure they have enough schooling fish. Because a school of three is not going to do a whole lot, you know? They just don't, it doesn't turn on whatever, it's not a releaser for the behavior as much as if you had 30. So if you have enough room for them to move in a nice long tank, and you have enough space for them to swim in uninterruptedly, and you have a large number of fish, often they don't need another fish, you know, that looks scary to them. They just do it anyway. So if they're doing this nice tight schooling like, you know, Harlequin rasboras will do or something like that, then it can look really impressive. Our dwarf neon rainbows are pretty good at staying together. They're not quite as tight schooling as, you know, rummy-nosed tetras, say, but they look nice and they usually stay pretty close together. So some people like that, some people don't. Any other top preferred behaviors? I mean, weird behaviors are fun. Like archer fish.
That would be cool.
You keep branches up above the water column in their tank and then put crickets on them and they'll spit them off. That's neat.
They spit the water up and knock the cricket off so they can eat the cricket.
Yeah, that's fun. Or there's like splashing tetras, which will actually spawn on leaves up above the surface of the water. They'll jump out of the water and lay eggs on the undersurface of a leaf.
Wow.
Things like that are fun to see, you know. So a lot of people, I think, breed fish not because they want to, you know, sell the babies, because a lot of times the market's not super great for them anyway. I mean, sometimes it is, but their real purpose is just seeing the really interesting behaviors that are involved in watching them spawn or watching them develop or things like that. So there are interesting behaviors. There are a few. There are a lot of others. So if any of you would like to say, write in or call in and tell us what are behaviors you're looking for in fish, then that would be great. We'd love that if you would do that. And contraindications, well, it's true that any fish like Oscar's that Andreka mentioned, any fish big enough to eat another fish probably will, eventually. And it might not immediately, but it'll get around to it sometime. And it's true that some loaches can cut your hands. I've been cut by clown loaches before. You've got those sharp little spines on their operculae, their gill covers, and they'll slice you with them if you're not careful. And it's like a paper cut. You don't even notice, and then you realize you have this little gash. So that's true. Puffers can take a chunk out of you. Some other fish can, too, so you have to be careful with that.
I think it's important when you're setting up a tank just to pay attention to the general temperament of the fish that you're putting together. If you're doing a community tank, you put really aggressive fish with more peaceful fish, it's going to cause problems.
Yeah, that's
just
true.
Just in general.
That's true. So, I would say, in the most general thing that I can think of that still I would consider useful to say myself is that first decide what you want out of your tank. Do you want a pet? Do you want a biotope where you only have things from a certain very restricted area of the world with a certain ecological situation going on and you want to reproduce that faithfully? Do you want your fish to be do you want a lot of variety, or do you want some really bizarre behavior? What are you looking for? Think of that first and then build your tank, and that can help. And hopefully that helps. So
those were good questions today.
Yeah, they were great questions. I hope we addressed them in satisfactory manner. So thank you, Andreka. Thank you, Russ. And we hope to hear from a lot of you very soon.
Have a lovely fishy week.
Yeah, and as I said before, so many species, so little time. Tune in next week to hear Russ and Kelly say other stuff about fish. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.